This is Scott Becker with the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. I'm always thrilled to be joined by physicians who are entrepreneurs, and we've got one on the phone today, Dr. Dan Field. Dan, can you take a moment and introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your career and what you do today?
Oh, I'm happy to, and I am so excited to be here on your podcast. So my name is Dan Field. I'm a second career physician serving as the chief medical officer of MD Staffers, which is a national physician staffing firm. I am the chair of our expert witness panel, and I still practice as an emergency physician. Going back in time, I chose emergency medicine in college. I was fortunate to graduate from UCSF Medical School, and I did my residency at the University of Cincinnati. I began my career at Kaiser, and then I retired after 30 years to begin my second career.
Fascinating. And two things. UCSF has become one of the great academic medical centers in the country. Any reflections on that? And any reflections on having a second career now? How excited are you about that?
Well, you know, it was near miraculous for me to get into UCSF. So I really appreciate what you've said about its elite status. It just was an unusual journey to get there, and then from there to the very first residency program in the country. You know, it's all a matter of statistics. You have thousands and thousands of people applying, and they can only take 70. I'm just very fortunate to have that grounding. I met so many valuable contacts over the years and who've become my friends, and it's been a wonderful experience. So my second career, you know, I worked for 30 years at basically the founding prepaid health plan in the country, you know, at least one of them. And it has been a remarkable career over that 30 years. And now I'm very grateful to have an opportunity to step out into the business world and practice some of the things that I've learned in the emergency department in this new setting. So those are my thoughts.
And talk to me about this before we get into some of the substance of healthcare issues and what's going on in healthcare today. You were at your first core career for 30 years. Any sense of whether that's a good number? You know, as I speak to so many people in first careers and second careers, it seems that at about, you know, some period of time, it's about time to try something different. Any reflections on that, on sort of like transitioning and staying in one camp while transitioning into a second camp, and your own life thoughts on it?
I think it will be impossible for anybody to work 30 years at one job in the future. It just doesn't seem like that's going to be the path forward. Even during that 30 years that I spent there, I explored many different avenues. For instance, I was involved in startups. We tried to do a handheld electronic medical record with a Palm Pilot back in 2000, 2001. I was a demo doc for Eclipsys, helping to sell their CPOE. I ran for office in our local elections. So I tried many different pathways that added to the sustainability of my 30-year career.
I think that's fantastic, and it's such a lesson for people. If they get just stuck in the grind of their own career and that's it, then the burnout is much higher. And it seems much higher. So a little bit of variety to go with a core career seems like such a healthy way to go about it. So congratulations on what you've done. When you look at healthcare today, talk to me about what you see as some of the biggest issues in healthcare today.
So Scott, my main focus has always been on sustainability. As with many of the guests you've had on this podcast, I don't see how the current trends can continue. I see that there are so many break the bank issues facing us. You can pick your favorite critical topic. You've mentioned some, but burnout, specialty drugs, treatments. And I see these all ultimately as issues of sustainability. Let me just focus on one because I like to drill down because that's what helps me think. So specialty drugs make up more than one third of all drug expenditures. In 1990, there were 30 of them. In 2015, there were over 300. And specialty drugs, there's no clean definition, but it's basically a drug that has a unique focus. It's usually very small. It's very expensive. You may have heard of Zolgensma, for spinal muscular atrophy, otherwise known as SMA. SMA1 kills within weeks or months of birth. SMA2 through 4 are survivable at great expense. We now spend about $684 million a year taking care of a very rare disease. How rare is it? 1 in 10,000 births. Okay, so 1 in 10,000 have it, and we spend more than $500 million to take care of the people. You could screen for SMA, you could screen for it, but it would cost you almost $5 million to prevent one SMA birth. Okay, so $5 million to prevent a birth. So Zolgensma cures the disease with one shot. And as you may know, it costs $2 million for that one shot. I don't see how this is sustainable to either screen at $5 million a person or treat at $2 million a person, and that's just one specialty drug out of more than 300. I think there's closer to 500 now.
So what's the answer to that? Because if you've got something that can change the course of somebody's life with this one drug, you want that drug, but how do you deal with the expense? What's the answer, and how do you, obviously, there's been this explosion of specialty drugs, partially because there's financially motivations for it. How do you fix that? How do you, I mean, any thoughts on it?
Oh boy. Okay. So this is the huge, this is the huge question. I think you have to take a step backwards. You know, you, as the farmer said, you, if you wanted to get there, you wouldn't start from where we are. We have to clarify the assumptions that underpin our current medical system, which I call ad hoc. That's, if you wanted to take one word or two in Latin words to describe our system, it's ad hoc. It just grew up out of a bunch of different motivations. So what I think we need to do is we need to isolate the actual assumptions that we're willing to live by. And I've got a list of 20, but I thought I'd share 6 with you right now just to let you know how my thought process goes. And then a brief proposal of what we could do to head in that direction. Is that okay?
Fascinating. Yes, please.
Okay. So 6 out of 20. So first one, is basic healthcare a right? And you can add to that in parentheses of citizenship ? Because, you know, basic healthcare right, is it for all Americans or everybody in the country? Number 2, our current paradigm is unsustainable. Number 3, what I call the unfairness doctrine. There's no system can be completely fair to all participants. Number 4, no one works for free. These are all things that we really ought to be able to agree upon. A lot of proposals sound like they would have all the medical people in the world offer their services pro bono, and that's not going to happen. Number 5, every proposal has costs and benefits. And number 6, unlimited access creates unlimited need. If you open everything up and say, you know, everybody's eligible, there will be an unlimited amount of need coming after that access. So now I'm going to give you a proposal, and I'm not saying this is the right proposal. It might even be a bad proposal, but I think it's important to throw the ideas into the arena to shake the box and see what works. And I think we should do A/B testing. We should try these in small areas. But my proposal is a two-tier system to provide basic medical care, and with the second tier, hopefully get some innovation. In the first tier, everybody would be eligible. It would be people paying into it on a sliding scale. And the second value added tier would require additional premium, but might keep a trickle of innovation going. Because if you just go the government one payer option, there is no innovation built into that system. So that's a quick and dirty, my view of the where we need to go.
Well, fascinating. And thank you. So in this context of this, and I love the 6 of the 20 assumptions, and very thought-provoking, and no easy answers ultimately. You know, in everybody's position of fairness sort of depends on where they are themselves.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fascinating discussion and a very hard one to break through on. In this whole context, What kind of advice do you have for healthcare leaders? And think here of somebody who's, you know, simplistically a leader of a physician group, a leader of a hospital, a chief nursing officer. What advice do you have for them as leaders? And it probably can't be one size fits all, but what kind of generic advice or general advice do you have for people?
Well, my single greatest advice for the country is make Robbie Pearl Surgeon General.
And so Robbie is a brilliant guy and the host of his own podcast, Fixing Healthcare. And you probably know him for a long time at your Kaiser days, but a brilliant, brilliant person. So, and you could hear about Robbie more through his podcast, Fixing Healthcare. Besides that advice for us as a population to make Robbie president or surgeon general, what other advice do you have for people that have to live in the system we have? Because even though there's lots of things that could be changed, you know, but how do we, what advice do you have for people that are leading today in this period of such challenges?
So the unfortunate thing is I don't have that strategic leadership vision. I admire it greatly. I focused on being a good follower, and I don't think there's a lot of discussion on this podcast or other podcasts about followers. You know, everything's about the leaders. But there's the concept that my friend Will Faber mentioned to me of the prime follower. And the prime follower is that person who stands up second. You know, you see the crazy person dancing all by themselves at the outdoor rock concert, and then suddenly somebody joins them. And it's that prime follower that really initiates the spark and begins to ratify the leader's vision and to move the organization forward in that direction. And you can see this process at work, and that's what I'm trying to do now. So I'm going to speak to all the followers, the people who want better for the system but aren't in the position and don't see themselves as the leaders. Then be a good follower. You know, it's either lead, follow, or get out of the way, but we don't talk about the followers very much.
Well, I think it's a brilliant, brilliant statement, and sort of, you know, that nothing gets done without teams and execution. So if you see somebody pushing a great idea, someone's actually got to make it happen. Some followers, exactly. Some leaders, some other people have to actually help move it along and make it happen. And I think a brilliant, brilliant thought, and I love that. When you talk about that, and this may be an unfair question, when you talk about that crazy person who gets up first and dances at the concert, are you talking about Dr. Pearl, or do you have somebody else in mind?
I have somebody else in mind, and I'm not going to speak their name here on this podcast. Robbie Pearl is anything but crazy, but he is the person who stood out in front. I will tell you personally, probably 20 years ago, you may not know this and your audience may not know this, but the Permanente Medical Group was within, I don't know if it was hours or 1 to 3 days of bankruptcy. This is not a well-known fact outside of the organization and even in the organization because, you know, time has passed. And Robbie Pearl came on board as the chief executive officer, and he articulated a vision which I was cynical about, and a lot of my colleagues were cynical about, but he did something so close to miraculous that he turned the Titanic before it hit the iceberg and allowed us to reformulate, not as the low-cost leader, but as the quality leader, and brought the Permanente Medical Group and Kaiser Permanente to the forefront of the medical discussion. He was anything but crazy, or, you know, he's crazy as a fox, but he had a singular vision, which we followed.
Yeah, no, and I say it facetiously. I mean, obviously just a brilliant person. What I sort of woke up to the quality of Kaiser's about a decade ago when one of the CEOs of one of the most prestigious medical schools in the country articulated in a discussion that I was in how all of a sudden over the last few years, they were losing all of their top graduates to Kaiser, their family care practitioners to Kaiser. And this was something very different than 20 years ago, where it wasn't that highest quality graduate that was going to work for Kaiser. And it was reflective of the tide that had turned and the strength that Kaiser had turned on as being just a high-quality organization, not just an insurance organization and cost-containing organization, but also one that physicians were proud to go to work for as their first job out of residency. And I was hearing this from somebody who was losing those people from one of the most elite medical schools, and seeing those people not go then to that medical school's group, but to Kaiser. And it reflects well what you talk about in Robbie and the group's vision to turn it into a high-quality provider, not just an insurance-driven provider. So fascinating commentary from yourself and a fascinating tribute to Dr. Pearl. Another question for you. Your career, when you look at your career, what are you most proud of? And then talk about one of your setbacks.
Well, I'm really pleased with the way I've managed my personal transition from a frontline clinician in a multi-billion dollar health machine to a team-based service provider in a private Inc. 500 fastest growing company. So I feel like I'm leveraging the two skills that I developed as an ER doc. That is, I am able to talk to everybody in the room and I am able to make a decision. Those are my two key attributes or learned skills. Scott Adams uses the word skill stack. This is something that I'm very pleased, and I've created a new career for myself that's been exciting, that has me flying across the country, giving testimony, that has me interacting with colleagues and still having time to do clinical work in a critical access emergency department. So that's when I'm thinking of the things that I'm proud about in my career, that's what I see as most intriguing to me. And then you asked about setbacks. You know, I've had setbacks in my career. For me, a key skill has been disaster recovery. So disaster recovery means you have to have, you know, a willingness to look at what happened, what brought about this setback, seek out mentors, and have a strong network of colleagues. So now I've taken that and I'm kind of paying it forwards at MD Staffers, and I try to be a resource for both our internal staff and our contracted physicians who are going through their own setbacks and trials and tribulations.
Well, that's fantastic. And I think there's two things you mentioned that I think are so true. I don't know if people appreciate them the most. This challenge of making career transitions well, particularly when somebody's been in a profession like medicine for 30 years, is not to be understated, the challenge to that emotionally, financially, in all kinds of ways, and to come out well on the other side. So congratulations on that. And then the disaster recovery concept in life, I think, is a brilliant idea. We talk about it so much in systems, but to talk about it in life and a disaster recovery plan, I think, is a brilliant, brilliant thought. So thank you very, very much. You're now working at a company called MD Staffers, and obviously this isn't a commercial for MD Staffers, but take a moment and tell us about what you do now, what MD Staffers does now, and what you're proud about with MD Staffers.
I would love to tell you a little bit about our company, Scott. MD Staffers is the 49th fastest growing company in the country. Last year, we were honored to be named one of Sacramento's best places to work. So MD Staffers is a national locum tenens and permanent placement physician staffing firm. And I'd like to tell you, our mission is to improve access to and the quality of healthcare in the United States. And you could look at us like we are plugging the holes in the dike. We do work with many of the top 10 integrated healthcare systems. And finally, I'd just like to say, it's really fabulous that such a young company has earned the trust of partners such as Adventist, and Dignity, and Stanford. We see ourselves as part of the solution to the healthcare crisis. That is part of our mission statement, is that we're here to get, you know, the docs to the people in a way that might not happen. And that's been a lot of fun, and I'm very proud to be part of that effort.
Well, that's fantastic, and congratulations on what you've done in your career and your openness in talking today. What a pleasure talking to you, Dr. Field. Just one more moment on, if people want to reach you and follow up and discussion with you, can they reach you on LinkedIn? Is there a way to reach you? How can people get more of your vision and thoughts?
Well, they can certainly reach me through ndstaffers.com. And I am very active on LinkedIn, and I encourage others to join the conversation. I love, like you like doing your podcast, I love sparking conversations and getting people to, you know, either take a stance, pro or con, and get their opinions out there so that we can kind of harvest those thoughts. So LinkedIn is where I spend a lot of my time.
Fascinating. And thank you so much. At some point, I'd love to hear the other 20 assumptions. I find the 6 interesting and a great start and fascinating discussions that have to be had. Dr. Field, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, really. Thank you very much, Scott.